Welcome to Tales from the Dance Floor, a podcast exploring the lives and times of people from all walks of life who follow their passions and made careers out of DJing, producing, parties, dance culture, and the music industry. I'm Phil Morse from Digital DJ Tips. Let's get started. So on this week's episode of the podcast, I have Rob McDaniels, who is the top guy at Beatport. So a real privilege to have you on today, Rob. Hello.
Hey, Phil. How you doing? It's great to be here.
Yeah, awesome. Well, listen, Rob, you're taking time out from your holiday as well, which I'm doubly thankful for. I was thinking just before we hit record, Rob, that, you know, if you look back at the history of dance music, which is quite a small thing, as you know, in relatively speaking, out there, dance music's still kind of a small affair. There's been kind of pivotal moments. The Amen break inventing about 15 genres, the Jupiter synth kind of like changing how music sounded in the 90s. And then there's been the technology changes in the software and music side of things. And I think Beatport has to be up there, along with kind of the invention of the iPod and what Steve Jobs did to disrupt the music industry. Beatport has to be up there as one of the companies that in dance music really has changed just the way it works and the way everyone does it. And I thought, how would things be without Beatport? And a lot of people would, you know, people are talking as we record about, oh dear, they might be changing the name of iTunes. How is that going to change my life? But can you imagine if Beatport disappeared? It suddenly made me realize how important Beatport is as a thing, and actually why people were so emotional when it went through its bumpy patch in the last few years before kind of finding its feet again. So, and then, of course, I looked at you as the CEO of Beatport, and you are a man with a history of disruption. It's kind of in your blood. Everything you've done in your career has been kind of aimed at disrupting the music and specifically the dance industry. So would you say that's a fair appraisal of you and then the trajectory you've had as a disruptor?
Well, don't tell my wife, but I do like to cause trouble. I think that I've had the privilege and opportunity of sort of sitting at the point where technology, music, and business intersect. And a lot of that has just been luck and timing. I'd spent the first part of my career in the soulless world of investment banking. And so to have the opportunity to work in an industry that you're passionate about has been, you know, rewarding beyond any kind of, monetary reward that can come from, you know, working in a job that you love. So, and for me, the opportunity to sort of continue to be innovative and thoughtful and helping artists. And so the opportunity to work for Beatport was one that I couldn't turn down.
So your passion for dance music, where did it come from? You say you're working in an industry you love, but where did that all start?
Well, I was born in London in the mid 70s and lived there till I was about six. And my family had a home in Switzerland, which we continued to go to even when we moved outside New York. And so I kept a pretty close connection to Europe and friends here, and they introduced me to dance music at a very, very early age. In the mid 80s, it was the sort of the garage house scene, and I got exposure to it every summer, and every winter on the holidays. And then for me, it was that sort of that moment where it all made sense to me and became a big part of my life was, I think I was 15 years old, and I went to the Notting Hill Carnival in London in late August with my best friend. And, you know, you just saw the streets packed with people, and on, you know, every other rooftop was a DJ, and everybody was just like looking up to the DJ like they were in the heavens. And just having an absolute blast, and all different types of people from different walks of life and different colors and socioeconomic backgrounds. And it was just, people were there to dance and have fun. And so from that point forward, in my love affair with electronic music, dance music, really never stopped. It ebbed and flowed as, you know, as I was in university and got into finance and so forth. But, you know, that's where it all started for me. And I always tried to stay somewhat close to that community. And, yeah. And so that's why it's been great to be able to work in the scene.
So you say that you started off not working in this scene, working in investment banking and finance. And how did that happen? How did you get into that?
I did that straight out of college. I went to university in just outside New York City. And I think I did that more because it felt like what I was supposed to do. I was through high school and college, I was always a bit entrepreneurial, and I studied entrepreneurship in college and was fairly good with numbers and business. It just kind of came naturally. So that was just the default, and it was the easy thing for me to get into. And so I moved to New York, and I thought I enjoyed it for a while, but then I realized that I wasn't actually creating anything or really adding true value to people's lives. I was just, you know, trying to sort of create wealth for the wealthy. And so it just didn't resonate with what I really wanted to do with my life. And so, you know, much against some people's judgment, I started Ingrooves after moving to San Francisco in my, I think it was my fifth or sixth year of finance. And I said, you know what, screw this. I want to start something that I love and that I'm passionate about. And, you know, so I created the idea for Ingrooves in my attic, in my San Francisco apartment, right at the end of the dot-com boom. Everything was blowing up in San Francisco, but, I figured it was actually a great time to start a company because everything became so cheap all of a sudden. The rent was cheap and people were less expensive. And so, you know, it ended up working out.
They say that there's never a better time to start a company than in a recession, don't they? So the Ingrooves part of your life, tell people what Ingrooves, explain Ingrooves to people who won't know what we're talking about.
Sure. So Ingrooves became the world's largest digital distributor of music by about 2010. But I started it in 2002 initially to bring dance music from Europe to the United States for licensing and film and TV commercials. I was a big fan of Moby back in the day, and his Play album was, I believe, the first album that was licensed to a major, where every song was licensed to a major TV commercial in the US. And I had these relationships still in Europe and especially the UK. And so I started to acquire the rights to license that music for film and TV. And I guess I started that probably in right at the beginning of 2002. And it wasn't more than probably 9 months later that a friend of a friend in San Francisco was working at Apple. He was the head of marketing, and he was involved in this new thing they were going to launch called iTunes. And he called me up and said, I heard you have a lot of dance music from Europe. Do you have the download rights, the digital rights? And of course I said, yes. and he said, well, great. We're launching this thing called iTunes in 6 months. Can you get more of it and, you know, deliver it to us? And of course I said, yes. And so I then turned around and called all of the labels and said, hey, I know you've given me film and TV, you know, sync rights. How about digital rights? And I had to take some time to explain what that was. And eventually they got it, and pretty much everyone said, sure, go for it. And, you know, next thing I know, you know, we're sending tens of thousands of dance music files to Apple for their launch. And we were one of the first independent distributors to work with Apple. And then that started the whole digital distribution business for Ingrooves. And that's what took off. I had a very fortuitous meeting with a gentleman who introduced me to David Kent, who was my longtime CTO at Ingrooves. And David had been the director of new technology at the original Napster. And David, obviously Napster had sort of come and gone by that point. He was working on some other music initiatives, but I told him what I wanted to do with Ingrooves and build this enterprise level distribution platform. And he got it, having spent some time building scalable enterprise software businesses. And he went off and spent, 12 to 18 months building the platform that, in large part Ingrooves still operates on today. And they handle the distribution for Universal Music Group and a number of independent labels. And I guess earlier this year, Universal completed their buyout of Ingrooves. But it was a great ride, ups and downs. We were doing stuff before anybody else, which was incredibly exciting. And the things we take advantage of today, or just don't think twice about, like delivering your content to dozens of places around the globe for release date. Back in 2003, 2004, it was pretty complex, and we solved it.
It's a story with, as you say, fortuitous meetings and being the entrepreneur who says yes and then goes away and works out a way of making it happen, which of course is, entrepreneurial 101, isn't it? But how, looking back, how much of this pivots on what you would call chance, just being, or was it, did you engineer being in the right place at the right time? Do you look back and think, I got myself where these things were likely to happen? Or do you just think, wow, what if that hadn't happened or whatever? How do you kind of like tell that story in your head?
Well, I think every entrepreneur has to be willing to fail and ready to fail and not scared of failure. You can't let fear drive your decisions, but it is an amazing motivator. So, for me, it was, I just needed to do something different. And then I was going to see it until the end. I wasn't going to quit. I wasn't going to let anybody tell me no. I wasn't going to let anybody tell me that I didn't know what I was doing. I mean, look, I couldn't name the five major record companies when I started Ingrooves. Back then there were five, but I knew the way that consumers wanted to consume music, and that the market would dictate how we as an industry needed to deliver them this content. And the same thing then happened with streaming, which, we were ready for as a company as well. So I just try to think about what makes sense and what's kind of the logical evolution of products and consumer behavior and technology, and try to put those things together and then get ahead of it. And I think a lot of it has to do with luck and timing, but it's also tons of hard work and commitment. And so, all those things gotta come together. And one of the things I tell entrepreneurs is don't have blinders on. Like, you may have the best product ever created, but if the rest of the ecosystem that you depend on to get your product to market and to have it gain traction, if that ecosystem isn't ready, then no matter how hard you work or how great the idea, it's not going to take off.
It's interesting because literally in my inbox this morning, an email has come through from Signal versus Noise, which is the blog of the Basecamp project management service, which has got tens of millions of users all over the world, of course. And it's just titled "Fuck Hard Work," and yeah. it's basically saying, celebrate creativity, insights, breakthroughs, rebellions. Celebrate anything but mere effort. And I guess I'm asking you, how much of that was involved here, or was it just, grinding away, or is it a mixture of the two?
Well, I mean, there's no formula for any specific idea or product or company. You have to find the right mix, and you have to have this will to achieve what it is that you set out to achieve and have that long-term vision, and then be methodical and patient and opportunistic, all these words, but it, but at different times, and you have to live and breathe it. And that's why, I mean, it becomes, your identity becomes wrapped up in it, which can become a little bit dangerous and hazardous to everything from relationships to your own happiness. And that's just something that's really hard to teach. But, you know, you just have to believe in what you're doing, enjoy the journey, and take it as far as you can. A lot of these things don't work out. And so a lot of companies fail, but that doesn't mean that you've failed. Every hurdle you overcome is a success. And so you get as far as you can, and then that's a success. And then you can always build on top of that experience and go do it again.
There's a couple of things here, Rob, that I want to kind of hone in on. The first one is, despite you disliking the kind of career that you felt was expected of you, do you think that without that background and without that training in business and in finance and so on, that you'd have been able to achieve what you've achieved? Do you think if you hadn't had that push and fresh out of school at 15, you'd thought, damn it, I'm going to be a DJ. Do you think you'd have got to where you've got to now, or got to the level you've got to now? Or was that actually, looking back, quite useful?
Yeah, but look, I think that all training and experience is useful. And I mean, when I was in finance, my sort of one of my professional mottos was just work as hard as I can and be ready to take advantage of any opportunity that comes across my desk. I wasn't in a rush to jump into something else, but I knew that if I did my best to excel in the craft that I was working on, it would open up other opportunities and I would keep my eyes and ears open. I knew that particular job in finance was not my destiny, if you will, that I couldn't imagine myself doing that for the rest of my life. But I just didn't know exactly when an opportunity would present itself. And I just think, I just try to use that in life generally and not rush towards a conclusion or a goal that may not be ready for me to accomplish it.
The second thing that jumps out from what you just said is that this necessity, when you're doing something you love, to kind of live and breathe it, and it becomes your identity. And that's a cliche of entrepreneurship, right? But you have to live and breathe, in your words, in order to have a chance of succeeding. And there's intrinsic dangers with that. I mean, you've been in this business now for a long time, and you presumably have come to a personal formula for dealing with that stuff. You're a family man. You're on holiday at the moment with your family as we record this. Thank you again. But, you know, what is your formula? Some people delineate. Some people just say, right, these are my hours, and outside this, you can talk to my PA or whatever. Do you even have a PA? You know, how do you work? How do you work in this very high-end job where a lot of people are relying on you and that you love, while kind of keeping separation? Or do you just not bother with the separation?
Yeah, this has been something that's definitely been a challenge throughout my career. I think with Ingrooves, I certainly got my identity very wrapped up in that company, and learned a lot from that experience. I also, one of the things that I do now is I don't try to separate my business life and my personal life that much. And I just let them sort of weave together and don't try to create these separations. And for me, I've just found a good balance. You know, I don't mind. I mean, if I'm working from home one day and I work from 6 a.m. to noon and get all my work done, then, you know, maybe I can have the afternoon with the family. You know, if I'm on holiday with them, I try to limit the calls to only the most important ones like this. But but yeah, I mean, I for me, I try to think of work as my passion and my hobby and what I love to do. I love to spend time with my family as well. And there's really no reason that those two things can't come together. It doesn't mean that I'm at every meeting or take every business trip or at every conference. I certainly try to empower our great team to go and be entrepreneurs themselves, and to take ownership over the business. And, for me, I just try to try to lead a balanced life and not stress too hard about it all. And I'm not apologetic. I certainly gotten to the point in my life where I don't apologize for much unless I do something wrong.
Well, of course, you're the one defining whether you've done something wrong, aren't you? If we said to your wife, what would you change about Rob's behavior with regard to work-life balance? What do you think she'd say?
She tells me to work harder, make more money.
Well, that's awesome. Do you ban mobile phones and smart devices at your dinner table?
No, but I probably should. And it's something where I'm trying to get better at not, you know, it's almost that you've got muscle memory now, right? With your phone where you just reach for it without even knowing that you're doing that. So, you know, on certain occasions we do that, but, you know, again, I try to, if it's my phone and I'm blocking out a certain period of time to be with my family, I'll just mark in my calendar that I'm unavailable for 4 or 5 hours and people know not to try to reach me.
I was talking to Laid Back Luke and he says he has a day a week off where he's not allowed to use his mobile device. And he says that one day a week is enough to show him how badly addicted he is to it because of exactly what you say, that kind of hand reaching for the phone that's not there. But I've got a £20 Nokia. I've literally got a £20 Nokia in my attempt to deal with that. And then I have to reach for an iPad, which is a bit more mindful. But I'll tell you, my team are constantly ribbing me for not. Anyway, watch this space. This is a developing story for all of us, right? So you mentioned Moby. I wanted to just ask you, have you read his autobiographies?
I have not yet. I've certainly heard some stuff from it, but I was brought up by my mentor to never talk a lot about your experiences in the music business publicly. You save that for private conversations, but you know, I can imagine it was also cathartic for Moby to do that and hopefully profitable.
Well, I thoroughly recommend them. They're an eye opener. But get thinking, Rob, because at the end of this, I'm going to ask you for a story. So get your filter on, but not too much of a filter, please. Okay, so I want to move on to Beatport because, of course, let's talk about Faction, because between Ingrooves and Beatport, you founded, I believe, Faction Entertainment, which is another kind of company. Tell us a little bit about what happened there.
Well, when I left Ingrooves, I took probably about 6 months off just to decompress. And during that time, a number of friends of mine, people that had become friends during our working together at Ingrooves, were managers. And they called me up and said, "Have you ever thought about getting into management?" And my response was no, because I wasn't necessarily at the time that interested in that kind of like one-to-one relationship. I like building scalable, large, disruptive companies. But I started to do some research and spend some time shadowing them and understanding what the manager workflow is and the relationship.
Just to be clear, we're talking about music managers, managing artists and DJs and so on.
Music managers. Yep. And I started studying the workflow and the dynamic between the artist manager and the artists and speaking to lawyers and business managers and everybody in the ecosystem. And I realized how fucked up the world of management is. And so I thought that there could be a better way to approach management. And, you know, I saw that the manager was being put in a position very much like a CEO of a company, but yet they had no training, no support system, and in large part, especially young managers. And so we started creating, Faction. And one of the key elements to the business model was also building a technology platform and an app that would help make managers more productive and communicative and allow them to interface and interact with their business partners and the artists in a more fluid manner. It took elements of like Slack and Asana. And so we started building that platform and started signing up managers, and it got really big, really quick. I think we had 25 managers in less than a year signed up under the management company, which kind of looked like a rolled up management company, a la Red Light or Roc Nation. And, but it wasn't, you know, the business wasn't scaling the way that I wanted it to. The managers weren't adopting and using the platform. They weren't, you know, the beta testers that, that we probably needed on the technology. So we began to unwind it and just transition it to being a more traditional artist management company. And a lot of the artists we had were, you know, friends of mine and or people I'd worked with in the past. And then I got the call from Beatport, and I realized that, you know, running a traditional artist management company wasn't what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. And we had some very good, great managers that could continue to run that business. And so when I got the call from Beatport, I jumped at the opportunity, knowing sort of the company as well as I did from the Ingrooves days when we were one of the first and their largest supplier for many years. And knew a lot of the executives along the way and was a big fan of the brand, obviously.
So what the hell happened at Beatport, Rob? You got in there and the place was a mess. It lost its way. There were things that hadn't worked, and the kind of goodwill was ebbing away out there. And it was just all quite sad. And as I said at the beginning, you know, people love Beatport. What went wrong, and what did you see as your biggest job when you got in there to try and get it back on track?
Well, they got wrapped up with the whole SFX bankruptcy, and just, I think, the SFX misguided strategic plan, right? I mean, that model was go public, raise a bunch of money, go out and acquire all these disparate pieces in the electronic music business, including a lot of festivals, but also then, you know, ticketing companies and marketing companies and download stores like Beatport, and create synergies by putting all these things together. Well, you know, if you throw a bunch of stuff in a pot and stir it up, it may taste like shit, right? So I think that's kind of what happened, and they ran out of money, and part of that plan of trying to put all these things together was in large part to move the focus at Beatport away from the DJ as a customer and chasing the festival goer as a customer. And mm-hmm. So, you know, they created a free streaming service where you could stream, you know, DJ sets, and it just ended up costing the company a ton of money and pissing off the core customer, the DJs, and not generating any revenue. So even prior to when I got there in the 6 months prior, the existing, what remained of the existing management team had gone back to the core business of just selling downloads to DJs. And that's what Beatport started doing in 2004. That's until a few months ago what it continued to do. And it went back to that business at the end of 2016, beginning of 2017. And then I joined sort of midway through 2017. And then we really started to say, okay, we've gone back to our core business. This is our floor. This is our base. How do we now innovate and create the next evolution of DJing, the next DJ experience, and finding new ways of getting music to DJs, as well as providing DJs more tools and services and becoming more of their key and core business hub?
And that, of course, is streaming. My next question is, streaming at Beatport kind of kicked off when you acquired Pulse Locker, which was the first attempt at this. And a lot of DJs will remember Pulse Locker being integrated into their DJ platforms. And it was a good idea, maybe a bit ahead of its time. And you acquired the technology. In all honesty, did the technology becoming available on the market kind of kickstart this thinking? Or were you already thinking about this and then, you know, the opportunity to acquire something that you saw potential in kind of reared its head? What order did that happen in?
No, we were already thinking about it. And in fact, when I joined, the conversations with Pulse Locker were already underway.
Okay.
And so we waited a bit to close the transaction. Pulse Locker ended up going into receivership bankruptcy, and we ended up purchasing the underlying patents out of bankruptcy. And when we looked at, you know, the next evolution of DJing, it made just logical sense that the access or streaming model would be the next phase. And we looked at ways of creating the technology ourselves, but it was clear to us that we would potentially be violating patents that were held by Pulse Locker, because they patented the process of integrating a music store into a third-party app or a DJ software, performance software or DJ hardware. They own the patent around that. So in particular for offline mode, which, you know, any, especially professional DJ or club DJ is going to want offline mode because you don't want to rely on an internet connection to interrupt your DJ set. And so that locker, that offline mode, is what is very novel around our, what is now our technology. If you think about SoundCloud or Spotify or any number of companies, they have offline mode, but it only works in their own app, right? But our technology works in third-party DJ software and apps and integrated directly into hardware. So for us, that was key, and we went out and were quite aggressive in terms of winning that bid, and we acquired the technology, and we spent a year not only improving, updating, modernizing the underlying software, the technology we bought, but also talking to our labels and our artist partners to better understand how to price and release this product into the market where it would be accretive to them, an add-on and not take away from their download business, and also where it could integrate more seamlessly into the DJ workflow and not be too disruptive to it.
So it's interesting that you mentioned how it could help your partners, as in the people, the labels releasing the music, because one thing that since there's two big questions that DJs have had to grapple with in accepting streaming, in our view, having spoken to many hundreds of them on this direct subject. The first one is they don't understand the difference between streaming and like locally caching your playlist from a streaming service, right? So the idea that you can say, all right, prepare a set from a streaming service and then click a button, wait 5 minutes, all your music's there, you can unplug the internet and go off and play. That kind of took a bit of education among our audience. But the second thing is they're kind of like, well, why bother? Why, you know, I'm quite happy buying my tunes and, you know, my workflow is not broken, so why fix it? And one of the things that we've noticed is coming through quite strong at the moment is this idea that with streaming services, there is the chance to benefit from curated playlists. So you could have a playlist created by a DJ you love or a label you love or a professional playlist person at Beatport or at Spotify or anywhere else, whose job it is to kind of be the record store manager, to kind of be the person that says, hey, welcome back, Phil. Here's a big pile of stuff for you. And then all of a sudden, instead of you having this pile of stuff kind of somewhere else, it's right there in your DJ software. And you literally click a little triangle and a playlist opens and you can actually sit there and experiment and explore a whole curated choice of music straight onto your decks. Is curating playlists something that you've got on your roadmap and something that you think is going to become a thing for DJs, DJing from and with curated material?
Yeah, look, that's a great point. I mean, curation has always been one of the greatest value propositions that Beatport offers our customers. I mean, our curation team is world class. They also live and breathe the different micro subgenres, in those cultures and communities. And so I think, they're finding those gems or helping DJs to identify those gems that can really make a set and make that DJ stand out. So I think that's key to any product that we launch, and certainly key to what we're calling Bport Link, which is our integrated streaming and locker service, which launched last month with Pioneer's new entry level software called WeDJ, and it launches in the next few days with Rekordbox. And so that's definitely core. Look, that I know there's questions around streaming, and a lot of DJs are saying, well, I don't want to change my workflow. Okay, great. That's fine. We're still going to sell downloads. We're still committed to that. When Bport launched in 2004, it's not like, you know, the next day every DJ in the world all of a sudden stopped, you know, buying CDs or you know, or putting music on and CDs and playing it that way. Some DJs still even play it on vinyl. So not every DJ is going to change their workflow, but the potential advantages to streaming, even if you're going to continue to download music, which we expect a lot of DJs to do, the Link service allows you to experiment and try to mix two songs together before you purchase the download. And so just that functionality can be extremely useful and worth the cheap monthly cost of, that tier is $15 a month. I think the huge leap forward for not only DJs, but the entire music community is what we can do with the data if DJs start to use Link in their sets, because we'll be able to track all the music that's played, report it to the PROs, because at any point in time, dance music is the most played genre of music around the world, but it's one of the least reported. And that's primarily due to issues of getting the accurate set list delivered to the PROs. Well, we'll be able to do that. We'll know, obviously track order, cue points, and that's data that can be valuable for the DJ to use for themselves, to share with management or the label, potentially if they want to share it with other DJs or their fans, or we can use that to teach people how to DJ. But what we're going to do when it comes to the data, as much as possible, is put the DJ in control of what happens to that data that we track from the Link software. Because we don't want to put them in a position where they're uncomfortable sharing that information. But I think there will be an increasing amount of DJs that are comfortable being more open source with that data. But it's hugely impactful and powerful. And you can just begin to think about all the things we can do with that data to help elevate the entire electronic music community.
I think a lot of DJs, as you say, are going to have resistance again to that. And it's because DJing has got this white label, kind of cover up the labels. My music is my currency and you're not having it, kind of certainly one way of thinking about it. And so this idea that what you do is being fed back to the mothership and you know, tough shit if you don't like that, is something that people will immediately jump on. Certainly the conspiracy theory type people among the community don't like the sound of that, but it's good that you paint the kind of positive picture. And I think it's worth reinforcing the point that the performance rights organizations letting the labels get their, you know, their trickle of pennies every time their tracks are played is something that is grossly not happening at the moment. It's kind of like you play an underground track from a small label, Madonna gets the cash, and I guess that's part of what you're trying to correct here, right?
Exactly. Yeah, we're trying to solve that problem, and it's a major problem, tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars a year. But look, as it relates to DJs, you know, some wanting to be more private and secretive, that's totally fine. Again, software allows us to build in optionality. And so as long as we are committed to the DJ as our customer and putting them in control as much as possible, the only hurdle may be something like, you know, where the copyright owner wants to get that information, right? So the label, if a DJ is playing a song, we may have to give some of that data to a label or publisher. But you know, we're still working out those details, but mm-hmm. Our goal will always be to start with the DJ as the person that is in control over the data that's coming out of their set.
Okay, so looking forward a bit, Rob, you know, just casting back through your career, you kind of wanted to get the music from Europe into the States, and you couldn't. Napster had gone bump, and there was no real way. iTunes hadn't launched yet, so in-grooves happened. You then took a look at management and realized that managers were ill-equipped, and you wanted to disrupt that area. You got into Beatport, and it's like, well, they've just taken it back to what it's always done, which is great, but what's the next big thing? What can I get involved in here? It was streaming. Now that streaming's starting to happen, what have you got your sights on next? What's the next big disruption? Whether you're going to do it or someone else is, what's the next big thing that potentially you find exciting in this game?
Oh, man, that's a great question. I've got my hands full just with what we're working on at Beatport.
It's why I threw in the maybe other people.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're also launching BeatSource, which is our storefront for open format DJs in the next month or so. And, you know, so that'll be a whole different brand and different curation and so forth. You know, beyond that, we're going to focus on a lot of, you know, the integrations and again, just the process of over the next, what we expect to be sort of 3 to 5 years of not only migrating, you know, existing DJs into this new workflow, but also just opening it up to the quote unquote hobby DJ world, which we think can be just, again, beneficial to activate and excite a larger community that admires and respects, appreciates, values DJing. And again, I think that can be great for our community. I mean, look, I get asked not too infrequently sort of what's next, because we're at the point, sort of the pinnacle, peak. If you look at history, we're at the peak of streaming, right? I mean, there's a format change every generation. It's about every 15 to 20 years. We're about 11 to 12 years into Spotify and the world of streaming. I think it was first introduced around 2007, 2008. So, you know, believe it or not, we're, you know, there's some kid in a garage or living room somewhere that's developing a new format or a new way of enjoying music, and we just don't know about it yet. And so, but, you know, I talked to other people and they're like, oh, well, streaming is it. We don't need anything else. And that's exactly the point at which something else usually gets created. So I definitely think that there's a new format out there. One of the things that I have been thinking is the next format is the DJ. I think that the DJ is the tastemaker and trusted filter of content is, and music is actually going to be a big part of the music ecosystem going forward. We have access to everything right now, and people have grown a little tired of that. And so, you know, through playlists and recommendations and artificial intelligence and so forth, you know, we're seeing a trend towards, sort of less choice. What's interesting, I find, about DJs is that they can read a room and play with emotions better than any algorithm, right? There's no computer that can look out at a dance floor and see the impact that a song or hook is having on the crowd. Only a DJ can do that. And the best DJs can do that and sort of play with a you know, the audience's emotion in a way that nobody else can. So I think that the DJ is the next format.
It's back to where technology and music meet, isn't it? It's back to the technology empowering the DJ to do the thing that only he or she can do. So, Rob, I said I was going to ask you for a story. I'm not going to let you off the hook. You said at the beginning, you know, music is a unifying thing. It's hit you hard at 15 when you were in London at the Notting Hill Carnival. I refuse to believe that between that point and being a responsible family man, there weren't times when you were very deeply up to your neck in the whole scene that we all were up to our neck in and that we all loved and that birthed all of this. Tell us a story from your rave days, Rob.
Yeah, I've got to be careful with this one. I I mean, there's obviously been a lot of great experiences in various fields and warehouses. One that stands out is probably back when I was 18 or 19, and I was living just north of Boston, and was quite firmly into the rave scene in New England. And I went with my very good friend at the time to a warehouse in and around Portland, Maine, and went to a sort of an all night house and techno party there. It was probably 1,000-2,000 people. And at the time, one of the biggest songs was D-Light, Groove Is in the Heart. And we all had a crush on Lady Miss Kier. And so we're dancing in this warehouse. It's probably about 7 in the morning. The light's coming through the broken windows. And I'm dancing right up close to the speaker, which is probably why I have trouble hearing these days. And I turn to my right, and there dancing next to me, I swear to it, was Lady Miss Kier. And I hesitated, but then I'd kill myself if I didn't go up and, you know, and say hello. So I just very casually, hello, huge fan, love what you do. And she couldn't have been warmer, gave me a hug, started to dance together. And there were other people around us, and it was great. And it was just like this loving feeling, that again, I think you can only get in those kinds of experiences where, it's just this melting pot of people, you know, whether you're famous or infamous or black or white, it doesn't matter. You're just there to listen to the music and enjoy the people around you. So that was definitely a cool experience for me, and one that just sort of, you know, resonated, you know, again, throughout the years. So.
Oh, that's brilliant. Thanks for sharing that, Rob. So Rob McDaniels, Beatport CEO, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts on your career and your life. It's been a pleasure having you on. I'll let you get back to your holiday now.
All right, Phil. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Cheers. Care.